The next case on calendar today is Nevada Association Services versus 8th Judicial District Court, case number 62748. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may do so. Do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, please, 3 minutes. May it please the court, counsel, we know the court is hearing multiple hearings on the super priority lien issue, so it's important for this court to understand exactly who the parties are in this case as well as the others. It's my understanding that tomorrow this court will be hearing argument on a case involving secured creditor versus secured creditor. Today our case is about homeowners and their association and collection agency versus real estate investors and financial institutions. I'm Pat Riley. I represent Nevada Association Services, which is an agency that collects monies on behalf of those homeowners and homeowners associations. Now, these are the homeowners who have paid their bills dutifully through the worst real estate crisis in Nevada history. In this case, real estate investors and financial institutions like Elsinore are seeking refunds every single time that there is a lender-based foreclosure on real property located in a homeowners association. I'd ask the court to consider the math for a brief moment. That's thousands of dollars in potential money damages multiplied times 30 to 40,000 foreclosures occurring in homeowners associations. The district court, for some reason, thought this was a good idea, even though those money damages would simply be sent back to the homeowners in the form of special assessments. I'm here to tell you today that's not only a bad idea, and it not only is it unfair for those homeowners, but it's contrary to black letter law here in the state of Nevada. The voluntary payment doctrine is as simple as it is old. Money voluntarily paid with full knowledge of the facts, although no obligation to make such payment existed, cannot be recovered back. It usually comes up in tax cases because it's designed to encourage finality of transactions, just as in this case where you have a homeowners association that bills and creates budgets on an annual basis. And they do that, they base their budgets in part on reliance on the voluntary payment doctrine because they presume that no one will show up 4 years later asking for a refund.
Does that totally override the legislative mandate as to the amount of fees and arrears that can be collected?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because what's happened is there's a regulation, NAC 116.470, which caps the amount of collection fees that homeowners associations can recover. And then we have the bigger question of how big exactly is the super priority lien under NRS 116.3116. That matter will be taken up by the court in the Horizons versus Icon Holdings appeal, case number 63178, which is fully briefed, and this court has already decided the decision in that matter will be clustered with the decision in these other cases because they have common legal issues. So what we have with the voluntary payment doctrine is a homeowners association in this case who's budgeted in reliance on the assumption that no one's going to show up 4 years later. And in this case, it was almost 4 years later. This case could not be a better example of the voluntary payment doctrine. You have a property in a homeowners association. There's a default on the first deed of trust as well as the homeowners association dues. Both the lender and the association at the same time are pursuing their own collection remedies. The lender forecloses first in September of 2008. Elsinore purchases the property for $149,000. The association's residual lien, and this is important, it's a residual lien. It's a leftover from the super priority lien based on the foreclosure sale of the bank. 3 weeks later, this is on page 502 of the record. This is very important. There's a residual lien of about $2,500. And Elsinore sends a letter saying, look, we disagree with your calculation. We think the super priority lien is only six times monthly assessments. If you continue to demand an amount in excess of six times monthly assessments, we will forward the matter to our attorney for legal action. 11 days later, this is on pages 1209 and 1210 of the record, Elsinore voluntarily pays to release the lien, and the association releases that lien in reliance. This is a sophisticated corporate entity. It is a real estate investor familiar with the law who has threatened litigation, but then just pays the amount. And this is key. There is no pending foreclosure sale scheduled by the Homeowners Association. That's where we get into a different situation from Cobb v. Osman, because all we have is a leftover residual lien. And by the way, they resell the property 2 months later at a $76,000 profit. That's an annualized return on investment of about 400%. And they don't file a lawsuit right away. They wait almost 4 years before they file their claim. Now, Elsinore agrees that the voluntary payment doctrine is the law of the land. They're not suggesting that you change that law today. They simply state that they're entitled to an exception under the rule, duress. Now, they didn't file an affidavit in support of their opposition to the motion for summary judgment. There's no evidence of actual duress. What they're saying is that the residual lien is per se duress in every instance. That's really important as well, because every homeowners association lien is immediate. So from January 1st, when your homeowners association lien payment becomes due, the association has a lien. And they're saying that that constitutes duress from day one. And if they're right, your mortgage payment creates duress when you pay it. Your car payment creates duress. Anytime a mechanic's lien is paid, it's done based on duress. Any securitized obligation, once it's paid, is based on duress, and according to Elsinore, can be reopened and challenged at a later time. That simply is not the law. And by the way, duress presumes that there is no alternative but to pay. And I say that the converse is true. If there's an alternative to pay, there can't be duress, right? Well, let's look at the alternatives that Elsinore had. This court held in Ham v. Arrow Creek Homeowners Association that NRS 38.310 provided the exact remedy for a unit owner, as Elsinore did in this case. It could have filed a claim with the Nevada Real Estate Division challenging the amount that was demanded by Elsinore. In the meantime, it could have done other things. It could have bonded around the lien. It could have escrowed around the lien. It could have found a tenant. It did none of those things. What it did instead was it paid off the lien because it wanted that quick profit. Elsinore is a real estate flipper. They wanted that 400% annualized return on investment. Members of this court, that's not duress. That's greed. And while I don't begrudge any business from making a profit, I really don't. I represent businesses. To make that profit and then to come back to my clients 4 years later and say, hey, give us a refund, is patently unfair. And it's contrary to the law. But the key with duress, and I'll tie it in with Cobb v. Osman, which is a 1967 case, is that payment has to be made to save the property, to save the property. In Cobb v. Osman, there was a foreclosure sale scheduled. And there was an obligation that was owed by someone else. But Mr. Cobb had to pay that debt off. Otherwise, the property was going to be sold out under his nose. We didn't have that in this case. We have a residual lien, leftovers after a bank foreclosure. The reason for the writ request today, I do not seek a writ based on a denial of a summary judgment motion lightly. I will say this, that when no factual dispute exists and the lower court is required to grant summary judgment, writ relief is appropriate. This is a black letter rule of law that is 135 plus years old. Elsinore filed no affidavit whatsoever in opposition to a summary judgment motion. There was no factual dispute. The lower court refused to apply the doctrine because of her personal belief that Nevada Real Estate Division arbitration was cumbersome and expensive, and in her words, was not a reasonable alternative. Never mind that the parties in this case actually didn't go through arbitration, they actually mediated the case. And never mind that in this court, that this court ruled in Ham that it was not only a reasonable alternative, it was the remedy that the homeowner is required to go through. And it seems to me like what the lower court was objecting to was really more of a legislative question than a judicial question. If you don't like NRS 38.310, and if you don't like the real estate division process, go to the legislature and change it. But without any evidence in the record, the court simply concluded, based on arguments of counsel, that it was too expensive to go through arbitration. And I say that was inappropriate. As a result of the lower court's ruling, homeowners who pay their bills will be stuck with multi-million dollar special assessments to pay damage claims. This is a case in which real estate investors and financial institutions are trying to monetize a disagreement over what NRS 116.3116 means. And it's one thing for us to disagree with over what that law means, but then to reach back years and say, oh, you're wrong now, so at the time we get to go back and undo all these transactions that were done years ago. Let me speak briefly about the class. I don't want to cover the same ground that Ms. Peterson covered in the Southern Highlands case number 61940, which I believe you all heard on March 4th, other than to say that the class members are the same as Elsinore. They are sophisticated corporate entities. They're real estate investors and financial institutions. They bought distressed properties with their eyes wide open, and they're big and small. They range in size from companies like Elsinore to the largest financial institutions you can imagine, to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Could you return to why this is appropriate for writ relief, though?
Yes. Well, with regard to the class action part of this, it's a jurisdictional question.
Right.
With regard to the voluntary payment doctrine
yes.
part of this, this is a black letter rule of law that the court was required to apply. And what's important is I identified for the court a number of cases that are languishing at the district court level that are all addressing this same question. And we're talking about tens of thousands of claims potentially that are ultimately going to come to this court unless this court answers the question. So there are principles of judicial economy that are at play. A lot of companies, a lot of associations, and a lot of investors are spending an awful lot of money to litigate claims that don't need to be litigated.
So you're making it mainly a public policy and kind of saying we don't need to give too much concern to the fact that an appeal would ultimately be the appropriate remedy?
Well, an appeal would be the parties and all the parties who are involved in these super priority lien cases would wind up spending hundreds of thousands yeah. and perhaps millions of dollars in attorney's fees. This is a simple question. Does a residual lien create duress? We all know what the answer to that question is. And if this court simply says, here's the answer to that question, I strongly suspect that approximately 90 to 95% of the super priority lien cases where damages are being sought get resolved.
Well, and your tax liens would even be under duress, right?
Every lien would be under duress, exactly. You get to open everything up. So, again, I thought long and hard before raising this issue because, again, it's a summary judgment issue.
Yeah.
But there are prudential concerns for this court, and the record absolutely undisputed, and it's a black-letter rule of law. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm James Adams, appearing on behalf of Elsinore LLC. My co-counsel, Pooley Prinsford, is in court with us today. I think you got one half of the story. Let's go to who my clients are quickly. They're flippers. Now, there was a point in time where I kind of objected to that term, but I'm used to it now because it's important for the court to know that the investors are flippers. They buy distressed properties. They rehabilitate them. They sell them so new homeowners can come in and pay their homeowners association dues. They also make a profit doing it. Collection agencies also make a profit at doing what they do. HUD. HUD is a flipper, Housing and Urban Development Department. They, Mr. Riley said that there was no affidavit in the lower court. There was evidence produced in an opposition or supplement with an affidavit, and there was a letter from HUD. And HUD was objecting. This is a letter from HUD to the Common Interest Community Commission. And I won't read the whole thing to you, but HUD was objecting to the practices of the collection agencies, basically violating NRS 116.3116 and overcharging for the super priority lien. And HUD maintained, listen, our job is not to hold property. We don't have the option of holding property. They said this dilemma also stands in the way, that is this dilemma charging too much, this dilemma also stands in the way of HUD's mission to resell HUD-owned properties quickly in order to reduce vacancies and reinvigorate communities. So the investors are flippers. HUD's a flipper. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, they're not in the business of holding property either. They're in the business of providing a secondary mortgage market. They're flippers too, because when they have to foreclose on a property, they're under contract to get that money back and to forward it to their investors, the mortgage pooling trusts. Private mortgage pooling trusts are flippers as well. They're not in the business of holding property. They're in the business of, you know, making interest. They're in the bin. If they have to foreclose, again, the mortgage servicing company is going to foreclose and transfer the funds to the investors. The reason why being a flipper is important and why just having a quote-unquote residual lien on the property, you have to marry the two concepts in this case. Because in order for my clients to sell the property quickly, which is what all flippers want to do, they have to provide free and clear title to that property, to the buyers. And they can't do that unless they pay this unlawful lien. This is just the, I think, brilliant part about what the collection agencies have been doing here. They've been holding my clients and their property hostage. So unless you pay that lien, you cannot sell that property. Well, if my clients can't quickly sell that property, they can't be in the business of flipping anymore. They have to go do something else. They have to start a new business. But they're in the business of investing in real property or, you know, in the business of providing a secondary mortgage market. They need to sell the properties. So it's important to understand that the coercive part of this, why the voluntary payment doctrine doesn't apply, is because it's a coerced payment. I'm not going to let you sell your property unless you pay me. What are the alternatives? Petitioner says, sue me. Sue the collection agencies. Sue the homeowners associations. Take 2 years out of your life, spend $100,000 and litigate it for a $2,000 claim. Well, that's not reasonable. Judge Scan didn't think that was reasonable. This is why it's not voluntary, because we're in the business of flipping. We got to sell these properties. We have to pay whatever they want because we've got to provide free and clear title to the buyers, or else the buyers won't buy. So if you take a look at the cases that have been written about this, there's a great case out of Texas, almost on point, only it's dealing with cotton instead of real property. There, a cotton grower warehouses cotton. He had a buyer for the cotton. The warehouseman was charging him warehousing fees, lien fees, actually lien the cotton. And when the cotton grower goes to pay the lien, the warehouseman says, well, I want more money. Well, the cotton grower goes, well, wait a minute, you know, that's against the contract. It's more than you said I'd have to pay you. Well, the cotton grower goes, I can't sell my cotton to this buyer who's standing right here unless I pay this. So I'm going to pay you. I don't want to. It's not right, but I don't have a choice. That's not a voluntary payment. That's a payment under coercion. And where you have that, this is what the Texas court said in Exporters and Traders Compress and Warehouse Company, where payment is made under a business necessity to free property of some duress or existing lien, it may be regarded as compulsory. And that's how the Texas Court of Appeals viewed it. It was a compulsory payment. It wasn't a voluntary payment. That's almost exactly this case. Now, there were, gosh, a number of other rulings cited in the briefs, basically for the same proposition. We've got an Idaho Supreme Court case. It says payment is also considered coerced when it is made to avoid the loss of a necessity or to prevent an injury to a person, business, or property. Well, this is a great injury to my client's business. If they can't sell the property, they have to provide free and clear title. The only way they do that is to pay the lien, not to wait 2 years to litigate, and finally, hopefully, free up the property. They don't have 2 years. Now, there is a case that was cited by the petitioner. It's Randall versus Lyon. It stands for the proposition where a payment is voluntarily made, you know, you can't get it back. But the facts of that case are completely different from the facts of this case. There, and it's a 333-word opinion, 125 years ago. And there, I think it was a jailer who retrieved a criminal for the county commissioners. County commissioners paid him some money, then sort of thought better of it and wanted some of that money back. And the court hired, well, you know, you voluntarily paid it, commissioners, therefore you're not going to get the money back. There was no lien. There was no coercion. In this case, by the way, there was a notice of default filed, which was produced by the other side in their briefs. A notice of default for foreclosure of the property. When they say there was only a lien, that's not true. If you look at the record, there was a lien, yes. There was a notice of default. 90 days had passed. Then my client bought the property, and now he's under threat of foreclosure. So threat of foreclosure is also a coercion. They could have foreclosed in 30 days if they'd filed a notice of trustee sale, but my client paying the lien. Violation of the law. These are some cases that I cited that I think are interesting because the Third Circuit ruled that all that is required to defeat the voluntary payment rule is mere improper conduct on the part of the payee. Mere improper conduct. Now, I think the violation of a law is improper conduct. And so does the Indiana Court of Appeals, where they ruled that the voluntary payment rule did not preclude a borrower from recovering documentation fees back from a mortgage company where the documentation fees were in violation of the law. So I think the court needs to, and will, make a ruling about the super priority lien as far as what are its limits. That's the Icahn case coming up next. Because if the court, like the other 18, like the multiple district court rulings that have stood for the fact that there is a cap on the lien, then the collection agency's actions will have been deemed unlawful, and the payment could not be voluntary. I think I want to briefly go into the evidence that actually was presented to Judge Scann, because I don't think this is not a case where a petition should be had. The evidence, well, the relief requested by the petitioner was a ruling from the court. On summary judgment, before any discovery had even been conducted, on summary judgment that my client and every member of the class, it had already been class certified by the time they were brought in, paid voluntarily. So what evidence was produced to Judge Scann that would give her enough confidence to make a summary judgment ruling before discovery that every single payment of all class members were voluntary, were uncoerced? Here's what the evidence that was presented by opposing counsel, by the petitioner, a set of CC&Rs. That's not really going to prove much about voluntariness or coercion. The original owner's deed, that really doesn't have anything to do with it either. The notice of default that was filed, where there's a pending foreclosure, that kind of says it's you know, at least as far as the class representative plaintiff, that it's a coerced payment because there's a foreclosure happening. The trustee sale deed where my client bought the property, the payment where my client paid, and the testimony by the owner of Nevada Association Services where he basically said, I wasn't the collection agency at the time. I don't know. I didn't file a lien. It's not my problem. Yet that's the company that's coming here asking for this relief. Now, why on earth is Judge Scann wrong in denying the motion for summary judgment? She had before her the notice of default. She didn't have any evidence to suggest that the payments of the class were voluntary. So she exercised prudence, and she denied the motion for summary judgment. That's why I'm saying this is probably the wrong time or the wrong case to proceed with this type of decision. Judge Scann said, my inclination is to deny the motion. I think there are issues of material fact on the voluntary payment doctrine. I'm really not convinced this is a voluntary payment. And of course, we supplied the HUD letter with my affidavit, showing the judge that at least one of the class members has got to flip these properties quickly. And the only way to do that is to pay off the unlawful lien. Now, regarding the issue of the court's jurisdiction, the lower court's jurisdiction, we did go into that last time we chatted. which was the Prem versus Southern Highlands case. And, you know, basically all of that case law was rebriefed. But there's something really important, really different about this case that the Southern Highlands case doesn't have. And that's there was a factual determination made by Judge Silver, who granted class certification. That factual determination was that there was a class mediation that occurred because there was a stipulation between the named class representative plaintiff. It was filed as a class arbitration. It turned into a mediation with a stipulation by the parties that it would proceed under all claims. And the position that we, you know, maintained and that Judge Silver agreed factually, looking at the record, is that it was a class mediation. Therefore, you don't even get to the issue in this case of whether the court had jurisdiction or not, or whether NRS 38310 was complied with or not, because there was a factual determination made. And there's nothing to suggest that she made an incorrect determination. Now, I could go into you know, the many, many, many cases that call for the vicarious exhaustion doctrine, the doctrine where only the named class representative plaintiff in an administrative proceeding needs to proceed through that proceeding in order to vest the court with the right to grant class certification to that single class representative plaintiff. Basically, the whole class doesn't need to mediate. As I said before, in the Southern Highlands presentation, the mediation arbitration program, well, it was funded with $4,500, a computer. I think they bought the computer with the $4,500, and an expectation that there would be 350 cases a year arbitrated. Now, we have over 520 claims in this case alone. So the idea that that NRED is the ideal or that it's even feasible or possible for all of these people to go through all of these mediations and all of these arbitrations all at the same time, because you only have a 30-day window in order to file your de novo actions, is simply, I think, ludicrous. This court stated in a case called Engelman versus Westergaard that either where the administrative agency doesn't have jurisdiction or it's vain and futile to proceed through the administrative agency, that you don't have to exhaust administrative remedies. And, you know, whether they had jurisdiction or not, I suppose that'll be a question someday. Maybe that will be answered, but it's not before the court now. This is just not the proper time to render this decision because of the factual disputes and determinations that were made at the trial court. Judge Scan's prudent decision at that time denying summary judgment, it could come up later in the proceedings. And I think the proper time is to review this, if there will be one, is the time for appeal. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
You have 2 minutes and 49 seconds.
Mr. Adams didn't come right out and say it, but I think he suggested that the voluntary payment doctrine was not good law because it's an old rule. I would submit to the court that Marbury versus Madison, which was decided in 1803, is still good law. I know it was decided in 1803 because it's actually cited to by Mr. Adams in his brief. What he was talking about principally up here was business necessity, not duress. The cases that he referred to were all business necessity cases. The Nevada Supreme Court has never adopted business necessity as an exception to the voluntary payment doctrine. I would like to point out, though, that this case does not involve a business necessity. The Texas cotton case, well, that was the farmer's entire crop for the year. And if he didn't get his payment, he was going to go out of business. That's a necessity. Other cases that involve business necessity involve utilities. The lights are going to be turned off. The water is going to be turned off. Well, of course you're going to pay that because otherwise your doors get shut because you don't have any utilities. The Randazzo versus Harris Bank Palatine case, Illinois has adopted business necessity. That was an extremely harsh result for Mr. Randazzo. And in the small world category, I grew up in Palatine, Illinois, and I went to high school with Mr. Randazzo's daughter. That was about as harsh a result as you could imagine. But they said it was not a business necessity because you can't accept the other side's interpretation of the legal rights, act on that, and then come back later. And remember, we're talking about 4 years later in this case. Mr. Adams referenced a notice of default. The notice of default was prior to the bank foreclosure, which is important. There's no threat of imminent foreclosure. No foreclosure date has been set. I've always, by the way, even if it had been set, Elsinore would have had the remedy to go to district court and immediately get an injunction, which it very much likely would have gotten, to stop the foreclosure while the parties figured out exactly, you know, how much is this super priority lien. Yet another remedy available. And the record does contain an affidavit from a title company saying, look, we escrow around these things. You can deposit the money with us. We'll hold it. We'll release the lien so that you all can fight about it later. That's perfectly appropriate. That's a reasonable alternative. But what Mr. Adams was talking about was, well, but we have to pay to release the lien. This isn't a real have to. This is the kind of have to that we say when we go to the mall and we really just have to have that. It's, they want to turn the property around and flip the property so that they can release the lien and make that profit. I'd just like to close by reminding this court of the size of this. Mr. Adams told you who his class members were: HUD, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, financial institutions, and investors. Now imagine the homeowners who are going to have to foot the bill for years of closed transactions where they're going to have to pay special assessments to refund money to those institutions. I thank you very much for your time today.
I want to thank both counsel for excellent briefs and oral argument. The matter will stand submitted and will be in recess for a brief period of time and then reconvene.